Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, his memoir is called My Fighting Family, Borders and Bloodlines and the Battles That Made Us. Out through Penguin Random House, Morgan Campbell joins us on the show. Welcome, Morgan.
Hey, great to be here.
So I want to start kind of with the acknowledgements, because you talk about, you know, you left your job at the Toronto Star.
Yeah.
But it wasn't to write this book. It sounds like kind of like, you know, timing-wise, that's not what you were meant to do, but then someone you ran into basically like encouraged you to write this book coming out of that period?
Sort of. I was playing with the ideas that became this book. And I left the Star for a few reasons, but one of them was just to explore different types of writing, different types of storytelling. I was up against the glass ceiling at the Star, and the only way to get out from under that glass ceiling and really see what I was capable of as a writer was to get out of there. So I was playing with these ideas, and what happened was I don't know how closely any of your audience follows like the media industry, but whenever a media person leaves a job, what they do is they do a Twitter thread about it.
Right.
And so I was in the middle of my Twitter thread about leaving the Toronto Star and talking about some of the kinds of things I want to be able to do. And then Scott Sellers from Penguin Random House DM'd me and said, hey, let's meet up in the new year, because this was all happening December of 2019. And Scott and I knew each other from the gym. I hadn't been at that gym in a while, but we used to train at the same gym. So he DM'd me and said, hey, what are you thinking of? And so a month or so later, we met up and I told him what I was playing with. And I asked him if he'd ever read a book called Boy Wonders by Cathal Kelly, who was a sports columnist at the Globe and Mail. Mm-hmm. And he said, he read that book. I commissioned it. I was like, perfect. So what I'm thinking of is a memoir in chapters, in essays, that kind of splits the difference between Cathal Kelly's memoir and another memoir called What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker by Damon Young. And I said, if you can think of those two things together, that's what I'm thinking of. And he's like, perfect, write me a proposal. And we were off to the races.
So was it structurally or tonally you were thinking of those two things?
Both. Structurally, in the sense that I didn't want to write like a straight front to back chronological narrative. I wanted each essay, each chapter to be a distinct story with its own beginning, middle, and end, so that you could read them all together and it's a story, or you could read each story and it's a complete story. And then tonally, yeah, because Boy Wonders is about a white guy that grows up in Canada. What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker is about a black guy that grows up in Pittsburgh. And, you know, my experience, my life, my identity straddles those two worlds, fuses those two worlds. I straddle the border. So it was structurally and tonally, I was thinking of like a fusion, mm-hmm. you know, of being, you know, the bridge between those two memoirs, between those two types of stories.
For sure. Now, I know, you know, you were a daily journalist, and the writing under deadline is a vastly different thing than,
yes.
than a book like this. And it's curious because you ran track. I was wondering, like, is the deadline like sprinters, and then now like you find you're like a marathon runner?
Sort of. Or the analogy I've been making is not so much sprinting to marathoning, but different types of distance running.
Okay.
So writing for the newspaper, writing on deadline. That's like being a 1500 meter runner. You know, and you graduate to longer form features or magazine stories. That's like running the 5 or 10,000, and then writing a book. That's the marathon, and they're all different. You know, because those are all different types of distance running. Mm-hmm. And you hear distance runners talk about them. Even distance runners who are like experts in it, you know, they talk about the 10,000 and the marathon as if they're interchangeable. And if you're a good 10,000 meter runner, they just assume you're going to be a great marathoner, even though the marathon's more than four times as long as the 10,000 meters, right? And so they all deserve, on the one hand, they are all about running, but on the other hand, and they're all like aerobic events, but on the other hand, one is over a lot more quickly and has a different type of strategy to it and a different level of output. And the other one requires like much more patience. And so, yeah, graduating the book writing, that's a lot like writing the marathon in the sense that it's long and protracted, and it's always going to take a long time. It's never going to be over quickly. And quickness is relative, you know, like even if you're a world-class marathoner, ooh, I ran 204 today instead of 205, but you know, it's relative, but it still took more than 2 hours. And so, and again, that's very different from deadline writing where you have to write good stories very quickly every night. You don't necessarily have to write great ones. If you're good and lucky and things line up, you can write some great stories. But that's not your job. Like when I covered Major League Baseball, you know, you're writing 100 game stories a year. They're not all going to be great, but you have to make all of them good and pop off for a few great ones. Whereas here, you are like, you know, siloed away from the world for a while. People have not seen this. They don't see what you're doing every day. But in the end, you try to show them something great.
When you're writing under deadline, I have to imagine, like you said, they should all be good. They don't have to be great, right? Like if you're filing, you know, a baseball story mid-July from like Kansas City or something, no one's expecting it to end up, you know, winning a Pulitzer or something.
But yes,
when you're writing a book, like that space and that time, does that give you too much opportunity to get in your own head? Like, are you overthinking things in a way that you wouldn't have done when you're, you know, filing something quickly?
Sort of. Like when you're a deadline writer, I look at it more the other way. Like as a deadline writer, writer's block is just a luxury that none of us can afford. So writer's block, I don't know anything about writer's block because deadline is 11, it's 10:22, and you got to bang out 600 words. Those 600 words come out. There's no such thing as writer's block, right? It's writer's block is a luxury that you can only afford if you have time. So because I really developed as a writer with these deadlines and without the benefit of the time that would allow me to have writer's block, I didn't really experience writer's block here. Like once I had an idea, I could, you know, get it on paper. Doesn't mean now. The difference is that when you write on deadline, like that first draft is good. You know, that first draft is readable. And you know, especially when you worked in newspapers on the East Coast, you'd file one time a fairly early deadline and you'd get one chance to write through and you could improve the story. But basically first, second drafts, that's what got published and they all had to be pretty good. Whereas in creative writing, that first draft, you don't want to show anybody. And the only reason you keep that first draft around is so that you can look at it long enough to write a second draft. Other than that, you just want to throw it in the fireplace. So to me, that was the big difference. It was above and beyond like writer's block and wrestling with deadlines. It was the fact that I had to write all these first drafts that I would be ashamed to show anybody.
So is that first draft for kind of like structural or architectural purposes? Like it shows you what you want to talk about within that thing, but you need to reshape it?
Yeah, you just got to get it on paper. And because no matter how good you want the second draft to be, the first draft is going to suck, but the first draft is necessary. Like to make another sports analogy, the first draft is like warming up. And you know, if I want to run the 100 meters, I can't skip the warm-up. And it doesn't matter how much time I think I'm going to save by skipping the warm-up, I have to go through this warm-up process to make sure my body is ready for this all-out effort. And so that first draft is, and throughout the warm-up process, especially early in the warm-up process, you might feel like crap because you were cold at the beginning and you don't feel good until you're warm, but you have to get warm to feel good. And so writing that first draft is very similar.
Are there any skills that transfer through from, you know, that writing under deadline to writing in this case? Like, did you find there were some things you could lean on or pull from?
Yeah, one was just, again, just the idea that writer's block for me had never really existed. So even if I couldn't think of the words initially, like if I have an idea, I have something to write. And so it's not like writer's block in the sense that I have an idea, but I don't know how to say it. And so any type of delays, you know, I didn't even necessarily consider it writer's block or procrastination. It was just an idea waiting, you know, to germinate and I'd have to walk around for a while. But it was the idea too that like I don't have, like, when I write something, it doesn't have to be perfect. And especially in this sense, it was a relief that the thing that I'm writing that's not perfect, no one's going to read it. Whereas, again, when you are writing for Canada's biggest newspaper and writing about the Blue Jays, and the Blue Jays have really high readership, and you write a story that's not great, you know, like, you hit send and you're like, man, I hope nobody reads that. And the only thing that comforts you is that tomorrow I can come back and write something better. Whereas here, I can always come back and write something better, but no one had to read the thing that sucked.
Now, you mentioned that you didn't want this to be a straight chronology, right? Like that memoir, it wasn't, birth to where you are now. How did you land on the structure that you ended up with?
A couple reasons. Yeah, I didn't want, one reason I didn't want a straight chronological narrative is that I'm not famous. Like, the journalism nerds kind of remember and care who I am or who I was from my time at the Star, but I'm not famous. I don't walk down the street and people say, oh my goodness, there's Morgan Campbell. That, because if you are famous, people are interested in an autobiography and like the events of your life lined up from the beginning to where you are now. That's for famous people. That's not for people like me. People like me, I have to write it in a way that highlights certain themes. And that means sort of breaking chronology. That's why it's more of a memoir than an autobiography. And two, the reason I wrote it, I wrote it in essays just, for the sake of my attention span. One, for the sake of me not being famous. Two, for the sake of my attention span, because if I was just going to sit down and write 300 pages straight, I would have melted my brain. And three, I wanted to write something that was, I'm going to compare it to two things. One, it's like a mosaic. Have you ever seen these photo mosaics? Well, let's say it's a portrait of Muhammad Ali, and you zoom out, and it's a portrait of Muhammad Ali, but you zoom in, and this portrait of Muhammad Ali is made up out of photos of Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. So I wanted to do one of those, right? So you zoom out, it's one complete story. You zoom in, and it's a bunch of smaller stories. And I also want to do something, because music is this theme that runs through the text, because music is what brought my family to Canada from the United States. My grandfather was a musician. He's from Chicago. He used to get booked in Toronto. He fell in love with the place and wound up moving here. And then my parents followed him years later. And so I wanted to write something that was sort of like an album, in the sense that I have a title track, which is also the title of the whole piece, My Fighting Family. And that I wanted to, again, because every essay is itself a complete story with a beginning and a middle and an end, if you want to go back and read part of the story, you can read part of the story without wrestling over where to start and where to end, because you can just go back. Just like when you go back and listen to your favorite track or favorite couple of tracks off your favorite album, you can just go back to this book and choose your favorite essay and read it again. So I wanted to structure it sort of like an album.
So the chapter breaks are allow you to kind of like almost like the hit skip forward kind of button on.
Exactly. But I hope this book is no skip material.
Well, I do want to talk music, not just about your grandfather, but you have a chapter on slow jams.
Oh, yeah.
No Sade.
No. And this is the thing. Every person that comes to me about this, there's always the thing that they like that I didn't like, and now I got to defend it.
Right, yeah.
But no, that's fine. Reason no Sade is that my tastes, I like Sade, but my tastes really ran towards like the 90s sleazy R&B. Like, Sade's a little too tasteful.
Sade not sweaty enough for you.
Yeah, I preferred the sleazy, begging, pleading R&B of the 1990s, like Keith Sweat, Silk, Lorenzo, people like this. So, and Lorenzo Smith was pretty obscure, but he if you go on to Spotify and pull up Lorenzo Smith, I Can't Stand the Pain, like, he could beg and plead with the best of them.
Yeah, I have to imagine you did open yourself up to a lot of feedback about slow jams, because everyone does have their favorites, right?
Like, yes, exactly.
Yeah. To me, she's like the queen of slow jams, so that's why I had to mention Sade.
A certain type of very classy, dignified slow jam, yes.
This is true. Claude Jones, your grandfather, pianist, contemporary of Oscar Peterson, and you open with, you know, Peterson, him basically like playing after Oscar.
Yes, that was, yeah, he would wind up, because like that was sort of the level my grandfather was at in the industry. Like he himself was not a star, but he played opposite a lot of famous people. So there is a scene in there where he's playing opposite Oscar Peterson in Indianapolis. Yes.
And then it's through his like knowledge of the Canadian scene because of Oscar a little bit that he gets tapped to come up.
No, not at all. Not at all. My grandfather was very reluctant to come to Canada. And it's strange because, again, he knew Oscar. So he knew that there was a jazz scene in Toronto because, you know, Oscar was from Montreal, but there was a point in the early 60s when his whole trio, Ray Brown, Ed Thigpen, they were living in Toronto and they had like a jazz school here. But for whatever reason, you know, none of that really got through to my grandfather. So it was just these Canadian booking agents that started calling my grandfather's agent, trying to get him to come to Toronto. And my grandfather, he resisted at first because he's like, it's too far, it's too cold. And my grandmother winds up talking him into just to doing it. Just try it, see if you like it. And then it was sort of like late winter, early spring, 1966, he finally does it. And then he's like, wow, this is what I've been missing. He loved Toronto because it was clean, the people were friendly. It wasn't as multicultural as it is now, but it was racially integrated. You know, and all of these were like, all these aspects, all these details, they were novelties to him. And it was really seductive. It was intoxicating. And so he wound up his first trip to Toronto was late winter, early spring, 1966. And by the summer, they had moved here.
He plays a central figure in this book, and in part because of his personality and kind of like his oppositional defiance that he seems to have, right? Like even just like that your grandmother eventually like won him over to come to Toronto. Did you have any reluctance to share this part? It's your story in the sense that it's your family's story, but like, you know, in writing a memoir, more often than not, folks are telling other people's stories within their story.
Yeah. And to tell my story, I have to tell the story of how we wound up in Canada because I am African American, but I'm also Canadian. Like these are both big, real, equal parts of who I am. I'm Canadian because I was born here, but like the idea that an African American family would come to Toronto, like there aren't a lot of us. So each time that happens, often there's a fascinating story behind how that happened. And so I have to tell parts of those stories in terms of the music. Now, in terms of my grandfather's personality, yeah, he could be really, really, really difficult. Like when you read the book, like My Fighting Family, superficially, but centrally also deals with like these fights within my family. The way I describe the book to people is that it's a story about growing up Black and Canadian in Canada, Black and American in Canada in a family whose two halves don't get along. And, you know, my grandfather, my mom's dad, and my dad's mom, they grew up together in Chicago and did not like each other. But personality-wise, they're very much the same in the sense that they both liked attention. They both liked control. They both liked doing people favors so that they could remind those people of the favors later, right? They liked the idea that people owed them stuff. And they like to be in the middle of these family fights. And so you get two personalities like that. The fights can get long and ugly and bitter. But I can't tell my story without getting into some of those conflicts because they shaped, you know, the trajectory of a lot of lives and they shaped who I am.
Well, they definitely shaped some of your parents', you know, struggles because, you know, these oppositional forces, you know, your Granny Mary and your grandfather Claude, that like that enmity between the two of them trickled down, it seems like, and then that impacted you as their grandchild. Did you have any hesitance about kind of sharing some of this? Like, was there any?
No, only because now, you know, I might get some blowback from other relatives that are like, oh, why'd you do Grandpa like that? Why'd you do Granny Mary like that? But You know, the question is always, why did he do my mom like that? Why did he do my dad like that? Why did she do my mom like that? Why did she do my dad like that? Right? And these are people, Grandpa, Granny Mary, who are also like, they, again, had this knack for all the good things about them. They also just had this knack for like treating loved ones really poorly, but were also really unapologetic about it. And so in telling these stories, like, why should I be ashamed to write about behaviors that these people themselves were not ashamed about?
Mm.
Like, there's a scene in the book where my mom's dad, it's Christmas dinner. My dad has cancer, has just survived cancer surgery, but the cancer has metastasized. We're not sure how much longer he has to live. And my grandfather, who did not like my father, spends all of Christmas dinner like studiously, meticulously, intentionally ignoring my father, to the point that everybody in the party could see it and could see this display of pettiness. But to my grandfather, like, because of this rivalry between the two families, everything was fair game and nothing was bigger than the rivalry. Nothing was bigger than this beef between the two families, not even cancer, even though my grandfather himself was a cancer survivor. And my grandfather did that, you know, without shame or regret. So now why should I not tell that story? Because it was a very important story when you think about the bigger story of our family at that time. And, you know, to him, that was normal. That was fair. That was justified. And so most people looking at it say, that's really petty. That's fine. It's true. But like to Grandpa at that time, he was not apologetic. In his mind, there was nothing wrong. So if you really feel like there's nothing wrong with what you did, then no one should have a problem with me discussing it.
Did that, attitude in some sense, like, steal you for facing racism in Canada growing up? Like, did you find that determinism, self-reliance?
Sort of. Because, you know, I was dealing with racism in Canada before I was old enough to figure out that, like, my mom's dad and my dad's mom could be really, really difficult, unpleasant, troublesome people. You know what I mean? Because when you're young, you know, your parents are your parents and your grandparents are your grandparents. You don't quite see them as fully formed characters, like, with nuances and rough spots, right?
Right.
They're just grandma. They're just Granny Mary. They're just grandpa. Whereas, you know, in grade school, you deal with people calling you the N-word or whatever. And so in grade school, I was already equipped to deal with that before I had a full idea of how troublesome, you know, each of these grandparents could be. But that also had to do, you know, it also just had to do with my parents. And that was how they taught us how to deal with bullies, right? Like, if somebody bullies you, you punch them in the face. That's that. And you might get in trouble with teachers, but you're not in trouble with mom and dad, because I told you to punch that guy in the face if he gives you a hard time.
Because that's one of the fights in the My Fighting Family, right? That, like, you do physically fight. There are these, like, emotional fights, particularly amongst your parents and their parents. You also then kind of have intellectual fights in the classroom, right? That you talk about, you know,
yes,
the challenging some of the curriculum and the notions. Like, is there one particular, like, can you pinpoint, like, which specific instance, like, allowed you to kind of explore that? Or was it, like, was that inculcated because it was at home, that, like, you don't take this from people in general, that, like, you could do that in the classroom and like, stand up to a teacher or, like, challenge a teacher?
Yeah, it was both, in the sense that, you know, by the time I got to high school, you know, my mom did tell me the story of how she got in trouble in grade school because she stopped pledging allegiance to the U.S. flag, because every morning you had to pledge allegiance to the flag. And my mom, you know, she was growing up in Chicago, and this is the mid-1950s. So this is around the same time as the Montgomery bus boycott. And if your audience isn't familiar with that specifically, they're familiar with the name Rosa Parks. And they're familiar with the name Martin Luther King because that's the movement that made him a national name. Before that, he was sort of a regional figure, you know. And this was happening the same time as Emmett Till, who was very much, you know, like my parents, in that he was a preteen from Chicago, and he wound up getting lynched down in Mississippi for allegedly, you know, whistling at a white woman. And so my mom is taking this all in. It's also the same time as Brown versus the Board of Education in Wichita, Kansas, where her family has to sue, take the Board of Education to court for the right to integrate a school. And so my mom, you know, she adds this all up and she's like, this is a country that's not loyal to its black citizens. So why should I pledge this loyalty to this country? So she stops pledging allegiance to the flag, and she gets in trouble from the teacher, who has figured out my mom's not saying anything when the Pledge of Allegiance is going down. And so, but for the whole rest of her school career, she would mouth the words, but she would never say them. So by the time I start high school, I understand that. I understand too how my grandfather, he integrated the ROTC at Fenger High School in Chicago. So the ROTC is sort of like a cadets program. It's like you wear military stuff, you march around, do this kind of thing. And the director tried to keep him out of that program because he was black, but there was no actual written rule saying black people couldn't join. It was just the teacher saying this. And so my grandfather wound up complaining to the school board, you know, which his parents would not have done because his parents were from down south and back home, like, you did not antagonize or rile up white people like that. And so by the time I get to high school, like, I'm familiar with these stories. So I'm, you know, sitting in these classes and reading these textbooks that literally try to whitewash Canadian history. And, you know, I'm doing all this sort of supplemental reading and supplemental viewing at home. And so these points in the text, like the part that you're referring to, is a class in grade nine history, where they were talking about the original film Birth of a Nation, which tells the story of the beginnings of the Ku Klux Klan, and the Ku Klux Klan are portrayed as heroes because in this telling of this story, black people, without slavery keeping them civilized, have gone wild. And so this Ku Klux Klan now has to come in and lynch black people to restore order. Except this textbook, and in our history class, it discussed the popularity of that film in Canada and amongst Canadian audiences without discussing the content of the film. But I knew, because of who my parents were and the kind of stuff they had as watching and reading at home, what that movie was about. And I had to make the point in the class that the content of that film was just as not, if not more, important to the popularity of that film in Canada than any of these other factors they tried to lay out. But this was an intentional choice by the people that wrote that textbook and designed the curriculum to gloss over some pretty egregious racism that was present in Canada in the early part of the 20th century. But luckily, because my parents were who they were, you know, they sort of positioned me to shine a light on what was actually happening for this class. And I do find it ironic too that I was, you know, the class was multicultural, but here I am, this first generation Canadian, my folks aren't even from here. And here I am telling you all about how Canada actually works.
Well, there's some intentional choices made in that in curriculum, but also some great intentional choices made in my fighting family. We're out of time, unfortunately. There's so much to talk about with this book, Morgan. Congratulations on its release, and thanks for taking time to talk about it.
Thank you. I'm glad you like it. To the listeners, you can get it at your favorite retailer. And if they don't have it physically, they can order it, or you can get it online.
That's right. It's out through Penguin Random House. Again, Morgan, thanks again.
All right. Thank you.